Thanks for listening to our podcast. We've got more information and additional resources at probe.org/podcast. And be sure to check out our life-changing Summer Mind Games Camp for high school and college students.
We are in the midst of an economic meltdown. How did we get here, and what's next? Kirby Anderson addresses these tough economic times now on Probe.
Anyone watching the news or looking at their checking account knows that we are in for some tough economic times. This week, I want to spend some time looking at how we arrived at this place and set forth some biblical principles that we collectively and individually need to follow. Who would have imagined a year ago that we would be talking about spending such enormous amounts of money on a bailout? The first bailout was $700 billion. You know, when these numbers are so big, we lose all proportion of their size and potential impact. So let me give you a few comparisons from a recent Time magazine article to make my point. If we took $700 billion and gave it to every person in America, they would receive a check for $2,300. Or if we decided to give the money instead to every household in America, they would receive $6,200. What if we were able to use $700 billion to fund the government per year? If we did so, it would fully fund the Defense Department, the State Department, the Treasury, the Department of Education, Veterans Affairs, the Department of Interior, and NASA. If instead we decided to pay off some of the national debt, it would retire 7% of that debt. Are you a sports fan? What if we use that money to buy a sports team? This is enough money to buy every NFL team, every NBA team, and every Major League Baseball team. We would have enough left over to buy every one of those teams a new stadium, and we would still have enough money left over that we could pay each one of the players $191 million for a year. Of course, this is just the down payment. When we add up all the money for bailouts and the economic stimulus, the numbers are much larger. Some estimate on the order of, say, $4.6 trillion. Jim Bianco actually crunched the inflation-adjusted numbers. The current bailout and all of the other money associated with it cost more than all of the following big-budget government expenditures: the Marshall Plan, the Louisiana Purchase, the New Deal, the Race to the Moon, the Savings and Loan Bailout, the Korean War, the Iraq War, the Vietnam War, and NASA. Even if you add all of this up, it actually only comes to $3.9 trillion, and so it's still $700 billion short, which is incidentally the original amount of one of the bailout packages that most people have been talking about. Now keep in mind that these are inflation-adjusted figures, so you can begin to see that what is happening this year is absolutely unprecedented. But until you run the numbers, it seems like just monopoly money. But the reality is that it is real money that must either be borrowed or printed, because there's no stash of this money available that Congress can put into the economy.
This has been Probe with your host, Kirby Anderson. To get a straight answer on our tough economic times, get Kirby's free transcript at probe.org. And join us next time as we shed some light on these dark times here on Probe.
What caused the financial crisis? Well, answering that question in a few minutes may be difficult, but let me give it a try. First, there was risky mortgage lending. Some of that was due to government influence through the Community Reinvestment Act, which encouraged commercial banks and savings associations to loan money to people in low-income and moderate-income neighborhoods. And part of it was due to the fact that some mortgage lenders were aggressively pushing subprime loans. Some did this by fraudulently overestimating the value of the homes or by overstating the lender's income. When these people couldn't pay on their loan, they lost their homes, and we had a record number of foreclosures. Next, the lenders who pushed those bad loans went bankrupt. Then a whole series of dominoes began to fall. Government-sponsored enterprises like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, as well as financial institutions like Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, and AIG began to fail. As this was happening, commentators began to blame government, the financial institutions, Wall Street, and even those who obtained mortgages. Throughout the presidential campaign and into 2009, there was a cry that this was a result of shredded consumer protections and deregulation. So is the current crisis a result of these policies? Is deregulation the culprit? Well, Kevin Hazzett has proposed a simple test of this view. He points out that countries around the world have very different regulatory structures. Some have relatively light regulatory structures, while others have much more significant intrusions into the market. If deregulation is the problem, then those countries that have looser regulation should have had a greater economic crisis. But this is not what we find. If you plot the degree of economic freedom of a country on the x-axis and the percent of change in the local stock market on the y-axis, you find just the opposite of that prediction. The correlation is striking. Draw a line from countries with low economic freedom like China and Turkey to countries with greater economic freedom like the United States, and you will notice that most of the countries hug the line. Put another way, the regression line is statistically significant. Now, if the crisis was a result of deregulation, then the line should be sloping downward, meaning the countries that are freer economically had a bigger collapse in their markets. But the line actually slopes up. This seems to imply that countries that are economically free have suffered less than countries that are not. Well, it may be true that a single graph and a statistical correlation certainly do not tell the whole story. It does suggest that the crisis was not due to deregulation. This week we've been talking about the tough economic times ahead, and it's interesting that as the financial crisis was unfolding, a significant economic book was coming on the market. The title of the book is The End of Prosperity. Recently I interviewed Stephen Moore with the Wall Street Journal, and he is the co-author with Arthur Laffer and Peter Tanis of the book The End of Prosperity. The book provides excellent documentation to many of the economic issues that I've discussed on this radio program in the past, but also looks ahead to the future. The authors show that contrary to conventional wisdom that the middle class has been doing better in America. They show how people in high tax states are moving to low tax states, and they document the remarkable changes in Ireland due to lowering taxes. I've talked about some of these issues on this program and in my radio commentaries, and their book provides ample endnotes and documentation to buttress these conclusions. What is most interesting about this book is that it was written before the financial meltdown of the last few months. Those of us who write books have to guess what circumstances will be when the book is finally published. These authors probably had less of a lag time, but I doubt any of them anticipated the economic circumstances that we currently find. Arthur Laffer, in a column in the Wall Street Journal, believes that financial panics, if left alone, rarely cause much damage to the real economy. But then he points out that the government could not leave this financial meltdown alone. He laments that taxpayers have to pay for these bailouts because homeowners and lenders lost money. He notes that if the house value had appreciated, believe you me, the over-leveraged homeowners and overly aggressive banks would never have shared their gain with the taxpayers. He is also concerned with the ability of government to deal with the problem. He says, just watch how Congress and Barney Frank run the banks. If you thought they did a bad job running the post office, Amtrak, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the military, just wait till you see what they do with Wall Street. The reason the authors wrote The End of Prosperity was to set forth what has worked in the past as a prescription for the future. They were concerned that tax rates were headed up and not down, that the dollar is falling, and that America is turning its back on trade and globalization. They were also concerned that the federal budget was spiraling out of control and that various campaign promises on health care, energy policy, and environmental policy would actually do more harm than good. One of their final chapters is titled The Death of Economic Sanity. They feared that the current push towards more governmental intervention would actually kill the economy. That is why they called the book The End of Prosperity. Yesterday we talked about the book The End of Prosperity, and today I would like to continue that theme by quoting from another economist. The Bible tells us that there is wisdom in many counselors, so when we see different economists essentially saying the same thing, we should pay attention. Robert Samuelson, writing in Newsweek magazine, talks about the future of affluence. He begins by talking about the major economic dislocations of the last few months. He says government has taken over mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The Treasury has made investments in many of the nation's major banks. The Federal Reserve is pumping out $1 trillion to stabilize credit markets. U.S. unemployment is at 6%, up from a recent low of 4%, and headed towards 8% by some estimates. Samuelson says that a recovery will take place, but we may find it unsatisfying. He believes we will lapse into a state of affluent deprivation. By that, he doesn't mean poverty, but he does mean that there will be a state of mind in which people will feel poorer than they feel right now. He says that the U.S. economy has benefited for roughly a quarter of a century from the expansionary side effects of falling inflation, lower interest rates, greater debt, higher personal wealth, to the point now that we have become overdosed on its pleasures and are suffering from a hangover. Essentially, prosperity breeds habits, and many of those habits were bad habits. Personal savings went down, and debt and spending went up. Essentially, we are suffering from affluenza. Actually, that is the title of a book published many years ago to define the problem of materialism in general and consumerism in particular. The authors say that the virus affluenza is not confined to the upper classes, but has found its way throughout our society. Its symptoms affect the poor as well as the rich. Affluenza infects all of us, though in different ways. The authors go on to say that the affluenza epidemic is rooted in the obsessive, almost religious quest for economic expansion that has become the core principle of what is called the American dream. You know, anyone looking at some of the social statistics for the United States might conclude that our priorities are out of whack. We spend more on shoes, jewelry, and watches than on higher education. We spend more on auto maintenance than on religious and welfare activities. We have twice as many shopping centers as high schools. The cure for the virus affluenza is a proper biblical perspective towards life. Jesus tells the parable of a rich man who decides to tear down his barns and build bigger ones. We can learn a vicarious lesson and learn to resist the virus of affluenza. Warren Buffett tells the story of two side-by-side islands of equal size, Thriftville and Squanderville. On these islands, land is a capital asset. At first, the people on both islands are at subsistence level and work 8 hours a day to meet their needs. But the thrifts realize that if they work harder and longer, they can produce a surplus of goods that they can trade with the squanders. So the thrifts decide to really do some serious saving and investing and begin to work 16 hours a day. They begin exporting to Squanderville. Well, the people of Squanderville like the idea of working less. They can begin to live their lives free from toil. So they're willing to trade for the goods with squander bonds that are denominated into squander bucks. Over time, the citizens of Thriftville accumulate lots of squander bonds, and some of the pundits in Squanderville see a problem. They foresee that the squanders will now have to put in double time to eat and pay off their debt. At about the same time, the citizens of Thriftville begin to get nervous and wonder if the squanders will make good on their squander bonds, which are essentially IOUs. So the thrifts begin selling their squander bonds for squander bucks, and they used the squander bucks to buy Squanderville land. Eventually, the thrifts owned all of Squanderville. Now the citizens of Squanderville must pay rent to live on the land which is owned by the thrifts, and the squanders feel like they have been colonized by purchase rather than conquest. They also face a horrible set of circumstances. They now must not only work 8 hours in order to eat, but they must work additional hours to service the debt and pay Thriftville rent on the land that was sold to them. Does this story sound familiar? It should. Squanderville is America. Economist Peter Schiff says the United States has been getting a free ride on the global gravy train. He sees other countries starting to reclaim their resources and manufactured goods. As a result, Americans are getting priced out of the market because these other countries are going to enjoy the consumption of goods that Americans previously purchased. He says if America had maintained a viable economy and continued to produce goods instead of merely consuming them, and if they had saved money instead of borrowing, our standard of living could rise with everyone else's. Instead, we gutted our manufacturing, let our infrastructure decay, and encouraged our citizens to borrow with reckless abandon. It appears that we've been infected with this virus of affluenza, and the root problem is to deal with this issue of content. Paul talks about this in Philippians, and he also talks about the need for us to also learn to be content. We need to apply a biblical perspective during these tough economic times.